CataractCoach.com podcast series episode number 161 with Dr. Pedram Hamra, revolutionizing cornea care through truly innovative translational research. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest who's going to teach us so much about the cornea. And that's Dr. Pedram Hamra from University of South Florida in Tampa. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you, Ray.
So tell us about your, my pleasure to have you. Tell us about your path in ophthalmology. You went from med school in Germany, then you were in Boston at Mass Eye and Ear and Tufts, and now you're in Tampa. Tell us the whole path.
Well, I started in medical school in Germany, and I fell in love with ophthalmology. I like particularly the anterior segment because my grandfather was blinded during cataract surgery and kind of left an impression on me. And my brother had strabismus, so I was kind of involved with a lot of ophthalmologists, even young, at a young age. Then I fell in love with research during that time, and one of my three department chairs, Klaus Hyman, said, if you want to do real research, you have to go to the U.S. because there you actually have the time to do it. Mm-hmm. In Germany, for example, you have to see patients all day and then go in the evening and weekends and do research as a side. And so then I decided to come to the U.S. I started at the retina the division first at USC, California. But then I noticed that I have more draw towards cornea, so I applied then to Skapins, and I got a position opened up. So I started there with Reza Dane at Skapins Eye Research Institute. It was back in 1999, like 27 years ago now. Then I did my residency in Louisville, Kentucky, with Hank Kaplan. I went there because he offered me to have my own lab and run my lab as a resident. And so
wow.
My technician was running my research at the site while I was being a resident, and spent my 3 years there as a chief resident, and then went to Mass Eye and Ear Infirmary for my cornea fellowship with an advanced 2-year fellowship they had. I then stayed on faculty. The issue was I was very interested in translational research, so partially I was trying to do a lot of imaging. Studies network in terms of biomarker development, and there were restrictions, partially institutional, partially because of intellectual property issues that Harvard has restrictions on. And so Tufts had a reading center, Berk, Boston Image Reading Center, and I kind of moved over to kind of expand my being able to take the research we were doing into the clinical space, where I then joined Tufts, was there for about 10 years, rose to the rank, the full professor, became the interim department chair for a year and a half, and then tried to move away after a while because my wife is from Southern California. She wanted a warmer place, and so we ended up being in Tampa. I was considering California too, but we ended up being here partially because of the weather and also the vision to build something bigger beyond the footprint that we had at the time. So I'm here to help Ramesh Ayala build something larger than we can do at a certain footprint as well.
Well, so you have a three-pronged thing. So you've got obviously very strong clinical care, translational research, and now obviously the big leadership role too. So you're juggling three things at once, basically.
Yeah, it's fun. I like the challenges and the exchanges and the variety of all of these.
Sure.
To do the same thing that over and over again.
So now there you've built a basically tertiary referral strategy, right? You have a nice center that you have specifically for conditions that are kind of under-recognized but profoundly disabling.
That's right. So we focus particularly on severe ocular surface diseases, both surgical and medical. In terms of the medical, we see a lot of neuropathic pain patients, see a lot of severe neurotrophic keratitis patients. Surgically, we're doing like things like stem cell transplantation, neurotization, and kind of try to fix the disease both at the medical and the surgical arm.
You've also
done a lot of clinical trials.
Yeah, you've done a lot of work with this clinical trial. Can you tell me about some of them?
I mean, right now we have up to 17 starting in the cornea field soon. These range anywhere from persistent corneal epithelial defect, stage 1 neurotrophic keratopathy. These are some multi-center, some investigator-initiated. We're developing devices to measure nerve function. So we're working on the nerve function side to look at how can we assess nerve function rather than just structure or before it gets to the severe end result. I've been looking at imaging biomarker development. How can we, for example, diagnose neuropathic pain and differentiate that from dry disease? And that has resulted now in, for example, the work with Ocure Pharma being doing phase two trials with them, and now planning on the phase three trials as a multicenter, because now we can, FDA allowed us to use that as a differentiator based on nerve structure changes. And we do things like dry trials as well, more various levels of both mild, moderate, severe dry disease, potentially graft versus host disease is coming in. And so there's other type of ocular surface diseases kind of that we're kind of involved in at the moment.
Yeah, when it comes to the corneal pain, sometimes we kind of think in just symptomatic instead of mechanistic. Like, what's the
Right.
reason behind it? And I think that's probably a switch we need to make, is switch over to mechanism-based treatments.
Well, I mean, as an ophthalmologist, you see, you diagnose, you treat, whether it's
Right.
medical or surgical. Here's one of the conditions where you have to think a little bit about what are you treating. Is it just a palliative, which then doesn't work well, or works temporary or partially? Or can you get to the bottom of it and treat the underlying disease or the underlying pathology, at least within the eye? And so there you have, there's pain is not pain. So you have neuropathic pain, you have inflammatory pain, you have nociceptive pain, and they can all coincide in the same patients. So a patient may have one or all the above, and they can have centralized pain. So the pain can be like a phantom pain from the brain. And so by trying to dissect that and target each of these arms, you kind of achieve better results in the end. It's similar to like dry eye disease, where the patients can have low tear quality, low tear production, they can have inflammation. So all of these, if you target only one and ignore the other, then you kind of try to fix a three-leg stool with fixing one leg.
Right.
Then the pain is kind of similar. So where you have to, you basically look at, is it centralized? Is it coming from the eye? Then you need oral medications or not. You need to understand why you get neuropathic pain, which is based on inflammation and nerve damage. So you're going to fix both. You use neuroregenerative therapies like serum tears or blood-derived products. You use anti-inflammatories to prevent the new nerve growing nerves to be sensitized again through the inflammation. And then we do here extensive serological testing for systemic to understand what is driving it. Does the patient have vitamin deficiency? Does it have celiac disease? Is it easier treatable, or does it have something that is harder to treat, like, I don't know, Sjögren's syndrome or genetic diseases that can cause it? But if you can get to the bottom of it, you can have better success.
Right, so we've got to treat inflammatory, whether it's neuropathic, whether it's centrally mediated, whether it's a combination here.
Yeah, so it ends up being like a cocktail in the end for the patient, not just one drug fits all.
Right, I like your analogy of the three-legged stool. If you don't fix all three legs, you're not going to use the stool. You're not going to solve the issue. Now, you're also using in vivo confocal microscopy on these patients then.
Yeah, I do. I've been doing it for now 15 years, probably in every single ocular surface patient walking in the door for me, because a lot of the things that cause the symptoms, like the nerves, you can't see on the slit lamp. The slit lamp gives you 50 to 50x magnification. You see the anatomical changes, but what is driving symptoms? It's the nerves. The nerves you can't see. And so one is we want to look at structural nerve abnormalities, and unless you see the neuropathy physically, you can't treat it, and you don't even know if it's there. Secondly, there's subclinical inflammation that exists in many of these patients. The eye is not really red, but you do confocal, and there actually are severe inflammation there, and that if you don't treat that, patients won't feel better either. So the benefit is you see things that you don't see on slit lamp, because it gives you 800 time magnification. So you're actually
Right.
doing kind of live biopsy in a sense, which is non-invasive still.
Right. You've also done a lot of work with microcorneal neuromas. Tell us about
Yeah,
that.
so these one of the things we were looking at is like when I first finished my fellowship was that I saw these patients and they weren't responding to what I learned. So I was in clinic starting as a junior faculty, and like 80% of my patients wouldn't respond to stuff that I was taught. And so the question was, why? What's wrong with these patients? So I started doing imaging. Perry Rosenthal at the time, I had a bunch of these pain patients. So I started scanning those with Debbie Langston. We looked at the herpetic patients. So I kind of saw that the nerves don't look the same in all these subsets of patients. And then when Perry Rosenthal retired, he sent me think 60, 70 of his neuropathic patients suddenly to take care of. And I had no clue what's wrong with them. And there was no treatment paradigm. So we started doing confocal on all of these patients. And I noticed that there are these structural changes that you see called microneuromas in the eye, which is known, which are basically terminal end bulges of patients who have aberrant nerve regeneration. So the nerve basically doesn't grow properly, kind of forms a nerve ball. And so then we did a big NIH grant, validated it to see if actually it holds. It looked at every single possible marker, did the analytical validation, looked at whether that correlates to pain and quality of life, and it did. And then developed the artificial intelligence software that for automatic diagnosis. And then finally, recently, just did a prospective trial comparing human to AI. And so that process kind of led to validating this as a potential biomarker for neuropathic pain by seeing these microneuromas on the confocal microscopy. In
Wow.
the neurology field, they did usually use decreased nerve density for neuropathy, but that is in the ophthalmology field too common because any surgery, diabetes, infection all cause the same problem. So it's not very, it's sensitive, but it's not specific.
So we'll also probably see these microneuromas, let's say, after corneal refractive surgery, right?
You can, I mean, you see them at higher numbers in patients who develop pain, but you can see them temporary or in the beginning, also in conditions where you don't have pain. So it's important that not anything that is a microneuroma means they have pain. Similarly, if you have somebody who has high blood sugar, hypertension, doesn't have hypertension, or high blood pressure has hypertension or diabetes, they could have had just a cake. They may have run up the stairs. So you have to kind of put it in context still.
But perhaps that could explain. We should look at these post-LASIK patients, let's say, who have this chronic pain or
Correct.
really severe dry eye, severe ocular surface disease, and we may actually find these corneal microneuromas.
Right.
And then, how does that influence your treatment protocol? You said you're doing it both clinician-based and also AI-based to detect this.
So, yeah, I mean, I use it, I look at it myself, but you cannot expect every place to have a confocal or every place to be able to go through all the images easily. So we will need to take it to the, in order to take it to the mainstream ophthalmologist, you need to make it simple. And so something that can take 15 to 30 minutes can now take 5 seconds if they have a confocal with the AI software. So that's much easier. But yes, the two things are, does it have microneuromas? Is it a peripheral pain, neuropathic pain? You could put an anesthetic drop and understand the location of the pain. And then based on that, you can then decide whether you want to just use topical therapy or want to use oral medications as well. Or you have to use only orals if it's just coming from the it all phantom pain. Because if you have patients that have 8 out of 10 pain, you put a numbing drop in and it doesn't change. And so treating that patient with anything topical doesn't really make a difference to them.
So then what's your mainstay for systemic treatment?
We tested out many drugs. So the main ones I use are TCAs, nortriptyline. Because many of these patients also have underlying mental health issues because of the pain, and that it treats both is a neuromodulator, treats both the neuromodulation and also some of the mental health issues. And we also use low dose naltrexone, which is basically an endorphin receptor blocker. So this results in increased endorphins, and it also has some anti-inflammatory effect on the brain. And so with the combination of these two, you can probably get decent success, but we use things like a gabapentin, Lyrica, Cymbalta, carbamazepine, oxcarbazepine, lamotrigine. There's other medications as well. Similar to a shingles patient. I mean, if you see a single shingles patient, you're just going to ignore the pain. You're going to do something about it. But if the patients didn't have shingles, ophthalmologists have a higher hurdle to kind of treat the patients themselves. They're more comfortable sending them out, and then they go to pain management or neurology, and they're gonna be kicked back to the ophthalmologist. It's just dry eye, and so these patients fall through the cracks at the moment. It's getting better though.
How can, for our ophthalmologists who are listening, how can they decide which of these patients should be referred to a tertiary center?
Well, I think that depends on the comfort level, right? Of what is the ophthalmologist comfortable treating. If they're not comfortable using new oral medications and they put the patient on a numbing drop and the numbing drop doesn't really change the pain much or not more than 50%, I think that would be a good patient to send out for oral management. Or if the patient starts failing conventional therapy even before they develop neuropathic pain because of chronic inflammation, then the question is, well, why is the patient not responding? Instead of going through 20 different drugs, maybe to look at the patient with a different eye and confirm this is, for example, just dry eye, conventional dry, or is it actually maybe something else? As
Sure.
many patients have seen 20, 30 doctors that went through 80 list of 80 stuff they've tried. And the problem is, as this they go through the system, that the centralization increases and that makes it even harder to treat over time. So the earlier you treat the patient properly, the better the prognosis is.
Tell me about your role in that. You did the very first randomized clinical trial for NCP, for neuropathic corneal pain.
Yeah, that was exciting. I think I was this was a sponsored study by Ocure Pharma. We did a single center trial, a randomized trial with three arms of two different concentrations of the drug and placebo. The study was like 12 weeks over treatment, and it was very successful in general, and ended up that one of the concentrations did the patients did very well. And so now they're expanding that to a multi-center trial of over 100 patients
Wow.
across, I don't know, more than seven sites probably. But it was challenging because these patients are not easy to go through the trial. They needed a lot of hand-holding. It had its own challenges compared to any other ophthalmology trial I've done. But it was very rewarding to see these patients suddenly get better very quickly within weeks. And it was really, it went better than I thought it would have gone minute before I started it, actually. I was positively surprised about how it all went.
Well, that's fantastic, and obviously great for the patients who've
Very
finally
great for the
sleep.
patients.
Right. So you have a lot of also first in field approaches. You have kind of distinguish between neurotrophic or nerve nourishing versus neuromodulatory or nerve calming.
Correct. It's like, I mean, it's like low blood pressure, high blood pressure, low blood sugar, high blood sugar. I mean, the nerves can behave in different ways. They can stop functioning or they can overfunction. They can be not sensing things, they can oversensing things. So in the neuropathic pain, they're oversensing. So everything is kind of amplified to the patient to feel it. There's a lot of noise, it's very loud.
Yeah, I mean, certainly this could be so, as you said earlier, there's actually mental issues with the patient too because of such incredible pain.
Right.
We've all
What's
seen
even more ch
the news stories of the patients who are, at the end of the rope basically because of the pain.
Yeah, and currently we're seeing actually there's overlap. So we can have patients who have both neurotrophic and neuropathic pain at the same time. So we actually have described the population, initial case studies, but now bigger now, that the actually subset of neurotrophic patients, despite the nerve damage and decreased mechanical sensation, can have overfunctioning residual nerves. So while they look neurotrophic on exam, they can actually have neuropathic disease at the same time. And those are really challenging to treat now.
Right, for sure. So for your average clinician who's out there who I don't have your deep expertise in cornea like this, how do I change my mindset from symptom-based management, which is basically what we're taught, to mechanism-based treatment? What's the advice you have for an ophthalmologist like me who doesn't have this expertise?
Well, I think we all went to medical school because we're curious humans.
Right.
And so let your curiosity and the inner child come out a little bit and see, ask about the whys. I mean, when I was a child, I was asking why about everything. And so I think instead of just seeing it and have a knee-jerk reflex and put something on and then send the patient out, first look at the patient more holistically in the beginning, kind of, because these patients have different phenotypes. They're not usually the average dry eye patient who comes in with like blurry vision or like some irritation. They have a story to tell, a lot of them. And so listening to the patient a little bit and looking at it in terms of why is this patient behaving like that will then open up the curiosity part and let you kind of try. And once you've tried the mechanism-based approach and you've seen the success, then it's really hard to turn around.
Right. Yeah, well, I like that. Keep the curiosity and obviously keep learning. Keep pushing yourself to do better and better for this, for sure. Now, we used to think, tell me how they're thinking about the cornea being immune privileged. We've changed our kind of ideas about this, right?
Well, I think the cornea is still considered immune privileged, but the privilege is not passive, it's active. So in the past, we thought that the cornea has no immune cells, the cornea has no blood vessels, but that's all because it's a passive collagen in the eye that doesn't have any access to the immune system. There's nothing there. But when I was a postdoc, we found the first immune cells in the cornea at the time, which refuted that. But now we actually have seen that we have over 20 different types of immune cells in the central cornea. So what they're actually doing is not the cornea is immune privileged, not because of passive collagenous tissue, but actively being keeping itself immune privileged through suppressing recognition of antigens and kind of triggering kind of immune responses. So it's actually actively staying quiet, not passively staying quiet. And so that's the big shift now, where we actually know it's actually an active process, not a passive process in the eye, at least.
Yeah, that's a very different kind of way of thinking about it. So certainly, I would always, in the past, think that it was just passive.
Right. So that's the big change now in the last 20 years. And I've been finding more and more now with the whole advent of new technology of flow cytometry and sequencing, single cell sequencing, more and more cells are being identified now. In the past, there was limited antibodies to actually find the cells, but now there's more better and better technology. And so it's a whole interplay of this very complex surveillance systems of but how they all work to each other to keep that happen is still unclear, because you have 20, 25 different cell types, and nobody knows exactly how they're talking to each other. And they also talk to the nerve. That's the whole different area now, the neuroimmune crosstalk, where we know that the nerves and the immune system regulate each other on top of that.
So it's a both directions. You've got a bidirectional
Yes.
action between the nerves and the immune cells, just talking
Correct.
both ways.
Yes. So the nerves kind of tell the immune cells how to behave and what to do, and they kind of suppress inflammation. But the immune cells make factors to kind of keep nerves there, for example, make neurotrophic factors. And so the immune cells are actually also keeping the nerves there and or not there by creating disturbance. And then, for example, in the pain system, there's retraction, there's different behavior of the immune cells because the whole system doesn't become homeostatic anymore. So there's disruption.
Right. So you got homeostasis versus disruption then.
Correct.
So how do, if those interactions then break down, is that what leads to these aberrant regeneration? How do we, what causes that?
So complicated questions.
I'm doing my curiosity. It's making me think more, like, wait a minute.
Yeah, so a big subset of these patients have abnormal nervous system to begin with. For example, they have small fiber neuropathy that is dormant. And so it only happens when there's something that triggers it. For example, eye surgery can do that, or infection can do that. And so these patients are functioning, but then when the nerves get transected or disrupted, they can't function properly. And so there's a subset of these patients that have what we call dysimmune small fiber neuropathy. So they have antibodies against the nerve repair proteins, as an example. And so the nerves can't repair themselves alone anymore. And that's where, for example, you get these neuromas. That's one area. Other areas, shingles, where these nerves are being changed because the trigeminal nerve is being infected by the shingles virus, and there's other things happening. Other areas is like metabolic deficiency or toxicity, like too much vitamin B6 is neurotoxic, to not enough vitamin B12 or vitamin D is also not good. And so all of these different things, like autoimmune disease, dysimmune disease, metabolic disease, genetic disease, can change the nerve repair function. And so that's where you get these aberrant nerves typically.
Wow, very interesting. Now, tell me, in your lab perspective, utilizing single cell transcriptomics and mechanistic disease models. So you're using this to find, I had to Google this, immune-derived trophic signals.
So I think you're talking about the new grant we have from the NIH. Yeah, so we were working on initially, one of my curiosities was, why do we get neurotrophic keratitis? Not how to treat it, but actually, why do we get it in the first place? Can we prevent it? And so to do that, we had to first develop different models for neurotrophic keratitis, because we had to mimic like surgical transection, herpes virus, depletion of neurotrophins, radiation keratopathy, just on and on. Because we had to first develop these models, and then we and chronic dry, and then we kind of did this. We did studies on the single cell sequencing and proteomics in these eyes and noticed that one of the things that is happening is that the neurotrophin levels are shutting down in these patients, in these mice.
Okay.
So then the question was, well, why are the neurotrophic factors shutting down? Who's making them?
Right.
So we looked at this again, at these, and then found that there's actually immune cells will make these neurotrophic factors. One of the A big portion of it is made by immune cells. We looked at which immune cells. And so based on that, we then wrote an NIH grant to actually study this more systematically to see which immune cells are responsible for making the most neurotrophic factors and which of them get dysfunctional to shut down their production. And how can we potentially then alter that shutdown process or amplify it again to reverse that process? So this is a grant we just started last year to actually study what results in neurotrophic keratitis in the first place. Because one of the things clinically we notice is that when you compare the amount of nerves in a neurotrophic patient to a dry or regular patient, by the time we see it clinically at stage one, they have lost 80% of the nerves already.
Oh,
So
wow.
something is gradually happening before they even present clinically. And so one of the things I would like to do is see if you can diagnose them early, understand why it's happening, and try to intervene earlier.
Wow. So, for a surgical perspective, how can we be less invasive then? Should we move away from, let's say, corneal phacoincisions, go back to the limbus or the sclera?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think the surgeries, first of all, the cornea has a lot of redundancy.
Okay.
So a normal person recovers fine from both refractive surgery, LASIK even, PRK, or cataract surgery. And so the nerves come in a whole circle around the cornea. And so whether the incision location doesn't matter, they recover usually within 3 to 6 months sufficiently. The question really becomes, why are some of these patients not behaving properly after the surgery and not recovering? And I think the more efficient or more prudent question is potentially, how can we identify the at-risk patients before the surgery, and how can we alter the post perisurgical management differently to prevent this to getting, whether it's neurotrophic or neuropathic. And I think potentially we did that in LASIK, where we did topography and figured out that suprachoroidal thinning results in ectasia, and we don't see ectasia anymore. And I think hopefully we can find markers that we can identify before surgery to identify the at-risk patients and also treat them then differently. And so one of the things, for example, results in neuropathic pain is chronic inflammation postoperatively. And some patients have already inflammation sitting there by the time the surgeon goes in. Some patients who have autoimmune disease, as an example, have more inflammation. And by the time you taper them off at 4 weeks, the inflammation isn't gone and just rebounds. And that's what that results in the neuropathic pain, as an example. And so by identifying these patients potentially through serological markers or some other markers prior to surgery, you can delay the tapering process, I don't know, to 2 or 3 months and prevent the whole neuropathic pain coming up. That's what I do with my patients. When I have neuropathic patients, I taper over 3 months rather than 1 month, and I don't see recurrences yet. And so something like that to identify the patients ahead of time would be kind of potentially more effective rather than the surgical main alterations of the techniques. I mean, it's already microsurgery, so I don't know if you can go even smaller.
Right, we're already doing 2.2 millimeter frequencies. It's already pretty small.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, the patient has to see, you can't get around that. So this is something that they have to do. But the question is, how can we prevent or understand if they're at risk ahead of time?
So those patients who are at risk, let's say the neuropathic pains patients who are going to have cataract surgery, we should be more aggressive in treating the inflammation post-op, or just more chronic? So do I give a bigger dose at the beginning, maybe use it, your topical steroids every 2 hours? Do I give intracameral triamcinolone or something as well?
No, I think it's the chronicity, not because I think when I look at, I follow these patients right after surgery, and the typical tapering works
Okay.
Fine. It's just a rebound, or sometimes it doesn't go away completely, and then they kind of gradually the inflammation lingers. So I think the longer therapy is more important than the hitting them harder. The exception is some patients have inflammation even before the surgery. So I think in those cases, you may want to potentially pre-treat it. Similarly, like people try treat the dry eye now ahead of time
Right.
because of various reasons. So if you know, if there's ways we can understand that the patient has inflammation, that can also be pre-treated rather than only treated after the surgery, which would be beneficial as well. On the flip side, you may have neurotrophic patients who need surgery and the neurotrophic disease gets worse. I think those patients could be pre-treated as well. So give you a better reserve in the nerves before you start doing incisional surgery as well. So that's another area that can be potentially improved upon.
So for these patients, when you do a, let's say, 2 or 3 month even course of topical steroids, post-op, what is your taper like? Is it just like for prednisolone acetate 1%, are you doing like QID for a month and taper down like BID for a month, once a day for a month, or what's your...
I mean, I typically do the regular tapering process for the first month, and then go QD for another month, and then I taper this third month down to every other day and twice a week, and then off. In a patient who has a little bit more, I know the autoimmune disease isn't controlled. I actually did a confocal. I know then I maybe do QID for 2 weeks, BID for 2 weeks. And then I go to QD, for example. So it's either one of those two. But I think the first, you don't go have to go at QID for a month is kind of, it's not really
Too
necessary. I've
much,
really
yeah.
noticed.
So regular taper and then just kind of
But then the tail, have a tail out there, like a 2 month tail.
for sure. So yeah, that's a very interesting approach for it. Now, what could we measure ahead of time? Is there some factor in the tears I could measure ahead of time to know which of these patients are more at risk? Is there something I should be doing? Like, how can I screen my cataract or LASIK patient, let's say, to know who's at higher risk for problem post-op?
I mean, the tears, it's possible that if you have things like MMP9, if the patient is MMP9 positive, that should be potentially pre-treated. If you don't have anything else in the tears that can be done commercially, that's all experimental, and you have to do, it's not something that will be mainstream. So the only thing we have is really MMP9 at the moment, that which is simple enough to do. If you have people have confocal, that's something that can show the shoulder cells. I do serology in my patients. I actually have a panel that we've actually started with 32 markers, and we narrowed it down now to 7. So we're trying to now do a prospective study, actually seeing if those 7 can catch most of them and can prevent the disease. So I think we're working on something to kind of develop a short panel that we can do quickly in these patients, whether it's at-risk patients or whether it's just any patient. To kind of do a short panel, identifying these patients ahead of time and then managing them differently, because that will potentially even save lives. Because some of these patients, as you know,
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, a lot of our ophthalmologists who listen to podcasts are on the young side, and they have an interest in doing what you're doing, which is both clinical and surgical work, but also then the research. So, what advice do you have for these young doctors to become a clinician scientist?
I think first, I think follow your passion. If you
Yeah.
can't do something you don't like, if you can't get out of bed to do it, that's the wrong job. So I think following the passion, asking interesting questions, but also aligning your clinical practice with your research is critical, because there's just so much time you have, and if you have different focus and you have a foreign focus on clinical practice and one focus on the research side. It's hard to divide your time that way and get deep and make a deep hole. But if you align the practice with the research or vice versa, then you can make a big hole and have a bigger impact in that sense. So think th those are, and have good mentors. I mean, the mentors are critical.
For sure. I mean, I'm just impressed that you ran a lab as a resident. Usually, as a resident, you don't have any free time as a resident. But to do a
Well, I mean,
whole
Hank
lab.
Kaplan was very kind. He pays for my technician. So I was basically, she was the working full time. I was meeting with her every evening after clinic, and it was fun. I mean, it was challenging, especially post call.
Right. Post call, right?
Once
You're
you've
up
done
the
your
whole night
three
with the ruptured
rupture
globe.
globes, yeah.
Right. Up the whole night with the ruptured globe, and you crank through a busy day clinic, and then you're finally done, and now you got to go to the lab.
And Hank was mentoring me at the time too, so he was actually meeting with me regularly and talk about the science and kind of had continuous mentorship during that time as well, which was critical.
Yeah, that's one of the very rewarding things that I miss after doing, I did part-time academic work for 22 years. I really enjoy that mentorship, and I'm sure you obviously love this as well.
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, that's one of the things that drives me every day.
Yeah. So now at USF, tell me, what are your plans? What are you building here? So you must have an amazing Cornell fellowship now.
Well, the cornea fellowship is good. They're planning on doing an ocular surface anterior segment fellowship as well. We plan to
Wow.
do a new additional fellowship focused on surgical and clinical ocular surface disease. We're planning on building a big clinical trial center right now. And then also an ocular surface institute for like surgical and clinical ocular surface, severe ocular surface diseases as well. So those are some of the things we're doing right now, working on.
Yeah, when I visited, I was very impressed at like the amount of very unusual patients that referred in. It seems like in the community, that's just like the main referral source. They send them all the very complex patients go right there to USF Eye Institute.
Yeah, it's been big difference to my practice in Boston because there we had like 45 cornea specialists, and so it was very
Right.
niche. Now here it's a whole medical desert to some level. I mean, everything comes here, so it's a lot more variety, a lot more severity. So it's a lot more pathology here that you see, and it's actually much more variable in terms of the type of patients you see and the severity of patients you see compared to Boston.
Right. Plus you have the huge referral of all TGH, Tampa General Hospital, which is such a huge center with such
Right.
really severe pathology, often very late stage even.
Exactly.
So yeah, you may see patients, who come and you have just exceedingly rare cases that were never treated for like decades. So they come and do absolute end stage.
Or very young kids I've seen here. I'm seeing a lot of kids now with nerve-related diseases. Like
Why do you
yesterday, I
think that
saw two
is?
kids under five.
Why do you think that is? That's so unusual.
I mean, they have genetic disorders, and so that can happen here. And there's one referral center rather than being spread across. So in Boston, they
Sure.
get spread, and here they all come here. And so we see a lot of these. I've seen just in the last month, probably four or five of them.
Wow. Yeah, because Tampa's a very large city and you just have the one medical school. That's it for the
Well,
whole
it's not
city.
just Tampa, it's a big catchment area. Anything south of Gainesville ends up here, north of Miami. So.
You got a huge encampment area then that's
Yeah.
referred to. Yeah, for sure. Oh.
Yeah, you have to think that this after Atlanta, there's just Mayo Clinic and Gainesville, and there's nothing else all the way until to Miami.
Wow, I didn't realize that until you point that out. So you have a patient will drive like 100 miles to see you, no question. Wow, I just didn't realize that. If you're going to give advice for a young ophthalmologist who's seeing patients in the clinic, let's say you're a senior resident, what's the Hamra approach to treating a patient who comes in with neuropathic corneal pain? With corneal pain, what's the approach to diagnose and then to treat, and how do you do it? Give us a stepwise approach meant for a senior resident.
I have the patients who come and fill a questionnaire ahead of time. So a lot of the questions I would usually ask and take time. It's already done. So I look at
Like which questions? Like what are you asking specifically?
we developed, I don't know, 10 years ago now, the Ocular Pain Assessment Survey, which is a 27 questionnaire looking at the pain severity, variability, range, quality of life as it relates to pain, what makes the pain worse, and what other symptoms they have, like light sensitivity, and how much improvement they've had. And so that shortened 30 minutes of questions into two 1 or 2 minute visual of looking at basically what's going on with the patient. And we also do the regular OSDI for frequency purposes. But when I walk into the room, I look at the patient in general. But just by walking in, I observe the patient closely to see how much discomfort they have, whether they're light sensitive, how they're behaving, their mental health status. And so I kind of look at the patient a little bit holistically to get an understanding of who am I dealing with? Because part of the importance of that is in order to make a treatment, you need to make sure it's feasible and the patient actually can do it as well, can afford it, can do it. And so part of it, you have to personalize. I also do confocal on all these patients. I look at the parameters in terms of Schirmer's test, nerve function tests. We do we do esthesiometry, and we do the anesthetic challenge. And this is all done by the technicians. So this is
Okay.
all done. So but before I even walk in, I know the nerve function status, how much of the pain is central or peripheral, whether they have neurotrophic disease or not, whether the cornea nerves are altered or not, and whether there's inflammation or not, and I have the whole patient. So I have all the things I really have for the patient assessment. I already have before I walk into the room. What's only left is just assessing the patient and the slit lamp exam to look at the staining or anything else that's comorbidity like laces, erosion, etc. And so I talk to the patient, have them tell my story. Typically for a new patient, takes about 10 minutes or so to at least hear the story from the patient's point of view, because then you can fill out holes. And I have also the records sent ahead of time so I can evaluate them, make sure that's nothing missing. And so with that, once you hear the patient's story, you have all the parameters you look at. The real question becomes, what have they tried and not tried? And then technicians already fill that out. I have a template. I do a review of systems myself with the patients, ask about the systemic findings, which are usually nerve-related stuff, like tingling, numbness, tinnitus, dry skin, dry mouth, runny nose, anything that's nerve-related. There's like an 8 questionnaire. And with that, I have a picture of their physical condition in terms of how it relates to the nerves. And then once I know what they've tried and not tried, whether they had side effects, et cetera, then I can kind of use my algorithm, which basically uses a peripheral with blood-derived products and steroids, and then eventually to non-steroidals or oral medications, which ones they've used in the past, if any, and then pick ones that kind of haven't been tried or adjusted. Many times patients may be on the right medications, but not on the right frequency or dosage, who adjust the dosage. And so based on that, you can then go relatively efficiently and get to a treatment algorithm that personalizes the treatment to the patient's disease, but also the prior treatments.
Are you also drawing their blood like you talked about earlier, these 7 markers you're looking for?
Yeah, I send all of my patients who have ocular surface disease for serology to a lab afterwards. But that's afterwards. That we give them at the visit, and then they go and get the blood drawn, and then we contact the patient if there's anything abnormal, and try to refer to whether it's immunology, rheumatology, neurology, etc.
Oh, very interesting. And then finally, my last is, can you tell a lot of young residents listen to the podcast? Tell us about your new fellowship that you're starting. It sounds like a great one to do anterior segment surgery, complex surgery, plus ocular surface. What does it involve, and when are you launching it?
We're going through the GME approval at the time right now. We're hoping to get that started latest by summer 27.
Okay.
There's a small chance we may be able to get ready even this year. It's basically trying to have a fellowship that focuses on both complex surgical anterior segment surgery as well as complex and clinical anterior segment diseases as well, not just pure cornea, which can be cataract refractive as well, but kind of focusing on the ocular surface or complexity side, which you don't get to train as easily in a regular cornea fellowship.
Right.
And so it's basically a combination of advanced surgical education and medical education, but the focus on anterior segment and ocular surface disease specifically, like keratoprosthesis, neurotization, stem cells, combinations, and all these severe ocular surface diseases on the medical side.
Wow. So yeah, so a lot of complex cases then. So not just K-pros, but also probably like other anterior segment reconstruction, let's say after trauma or terrible zonulopathy. So they'll do cataracts, they'll do sutured
Correct.
lenses, they'll do all
All
the
of the
cornea,
above, yeah.
maybe even some glaucoma in there too. Sometimes these patients need all the above.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you need to know and learn how to build all these sunset syndrome and all these dislocated lenses, and you need to learn how to manage all these now, because there's so many of these Yamanis,
Right.
everything is included.
Well, that sounds like a great fellowship. I'm sure you'll get a ton of applicants for that. That'll be a great amount of hands-on.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good mentors here. I mean, we have one, two, five people who do cornea, and so all of them will be mentors in that, and everybody will provide certain expertise level and then training for the fellows as well.
Right, and plus probably opportunity for some research. Some like you with you some truly groundbreaking research.
Yeah, I mean, if they like to do that, sure, it's not mandatory, but I mean, some people are interested and some are not, but that's definitely a big plus.
Right. You can do fellowship work all day, do the ruptured globes, do a ton of surgery, do a ton of clinic, and then in the evenings, like you used to do, now you can do it, you run a lab. That's just amazing. I think it'll be a fantastic pleasure. I want to thank you for taking the time. We've been talking almost an hour. Thank you for taking the time to do this podcast. I really enjoyed it.
Very much, man. Thanks for the invitation today.
My pleasure. Remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we got a new Catter Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Anywhere you find podcasts, you find the Catter Coach podcast. It's the top podcast in all of ophthalmology. And of course, we got a new Catter Coach video every single day. So until next time, I'll catch you later.